week in Parliament is one for the history books.
It was an historic defeat for the government. The first time in decades a government has lost a vote on legislation in the House of Representatives.
Fresh from a historic defeat at the hands of Labor and the crossbench, Scott Morrison pledged to reopen the Christmas Island Detention Centre in preparation for what he warns will be an influx of transfers from Manus and Nauru and boat arrivals from Indonesia after the Medivac bill passed the Parliament against the government's wishes. For a time on Tuesday afternoon, there was frantic talk of a constitutional crisis. Some fancy footwork in the House of Representatives headed that off, but both the government and the opposition have come out of the last few days having lost some skin. Who now has the upper hand depends on your point of view. The Prime Minister has doubled down on Operation Sovereign Borders and had this message for people smugglers during a tense exchange with a journalist on Wednesday.
The law that passed the House yesterday clearly ring fences to the current cohort. So what Mr Abbott is saying is not true.
No, I'm sorry. You fail to understand that people smugglers don't deal with the nuance of the Canberra bubble.
Retreating into defence mode, government front benchers channelled Trump, saying the Medivac bill will bring rapists, murderers and pedophiles to Australia.
Isn't it better to stay off the hyperbole, though, in terms of saying rapists and pedophiles? And I mean, people can see through that.
Well, unfortunately, that's what we're going to get in the future. And unfortunately, that's
what... It's not true, though, Michael McCormack, that rapists and murderers would come here.
Well, it could be if they... It could well be.
And now everything old is new again. We're facing a federal election campaign with border security in play.
I'm standing between people smugglers and bringing a boat to Australia. Last time I did that, you didn't get here.
Australia can have strong borders and be compassionate to the treatment of people in their care.
There's one more week of Parliament before the April federal budget and the likely kickoff of the election campaign, so strap yourselves in. From the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Please Explain, a weekly podcast that gives the full story on some of the most significant issues facing Australia. I'm Tori Maguire. Later on, we'll be joined by Matthew Knott, our reporter in the US, who will take us inside Donald Trump's rally on the Mexican border earlier this week. But for our regular roundtable powwow, I'm joined by David Crowe, our chief political correspondent in Canberra, who's just back from a break where you weren't really having a holiday, were you, David? You were frantically writing a book. Welcome back.
Thank you, Tori.
And I'm also joined by Jacqueline Malley, a senior writer and columnist in Sydney. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, Tori.
David, I just want to start with the nitty-gritty. How many people are still in detention in offshore detention centres?
There are about 1,000 people on Manus Island and Nauru who could qualify for medical transfers after the bill, under the bill that was passed by the Parliament this week. The estimates vary as to how many of those would actually get applications signed off by doctors for them to come to Australia for an assessment and possibly medical treatment. But there is that basic cohort of 1,000 people who could qualify under the bill. And the bill, of course, has been amended so that it only applies to those people currently on Manus Island and Nauru.
And just technically, what has to happen to bring someone here? What's changed? What's different?
What's different is the fact that any two doctors can make an assessment of any of these people and recommend their transfer. Previously, there was only an in-house medical system where somebody had to be referred within the systems in place on Manus and Nauru. The law enables any two doctors in Australia, and they could be anywhere in Australia, and they could assess this person over Skype, for instance, and they could make a recommendation to have that person transferred to Australia for an assessment. Now, that recommendation would then go to a medical panel appointed by the government. If the medical panel signs off on that recommendation, then it would go to the minister, and the minister would have some grounds upon which to turn that person away and reject the transfer. Those could be security grounds. They're a threat to border integrity, or they're a threat in terms of espionage. But it could also be criminal grounds. If they have been convicted of a crime and served a prison term of 1 year or more, that's a specific ground for rejection in the new law.
So, Jackie, the Prime Minister did a press conference the morning after this bill was passed, where he said that he had been provided with advice that because of the passage of this bill, he had to ramp up Operation Sovereign Borders, which is the operation that runs the boat turnbacks. And he announced that he would reopen the mothballed Christmas Island Detention Centre at a cost of $100 million this financial year, and I think $300 million next financial year. We can't question the advice that he was given, because that's given directly to him by experts and officials. But how political an act do you think that was?
I mean, the minute I heard it, it felt highly political to me. It wasn't immediately apparent why Christmas Island needed to be reopened. As you say, it's the Prime Minister is presumably acting on the advice that he's been given by the security agencies, advice that we're not privy to, at least in this instance. Although I would also say the government's been playing pretty fast and loose with security advice over the last week or so. It's still not entirely clear to me what purpose Christmas Island presents. I know that David had in his story this morning that some of the medical transferees could go to Christmas Island instead of coming onto the mainland of Australia. I presume that's because I suppose it would mean that they have a disincentive or a lack of incentive if they think they're going to get to mainland Australia by trumping up, I don't know, some sort of medical condition. They won't. They'll actually go to Christmas Island. And then I also understand that the other reason is that if we do see more arrivals, because Christmas Island is so close to Indonesia, it's sort of the most direct route or the easiest mark for people smugglers to send people to Australia, they might see more boat arrivals. I mean, I don't know. I mean, David would be able to shed more light on this, but I don't know that the government has actually given a very specific explanation as to why the Christmas Island Centre needs to be reopened.
It's mostly different explanations at different points in time from different ministers.
Yeah.
Scott Morrison said on Wednesday that it would be needed for transfers, that's medical transfers from Nauru and Manus, but also in case of further boat arrivals. So there's really that double-pronged justification. Both are, in a sense, hypothetical, but the argument is that they have to get a detention centre up and running now. Now, of course, there are detention centres that they could use in mainland Australia, but they've chosen to use Christmas Island. It's obviously the best known detention centre to most Australian voters. And so that's why it's hard not to see the political impact of the announcement of the reopening of Christmas Island as a way to sort of jolt the electorate into focusing on what this means.
Particularly when you think about, I mean, the people that they have had to or have transferred already under the pre-existing or the old system of medical transfers, because we've had several hundred medical transfers in the last, I don't know, a few years anyway, and they've all been absorbed into the detention system on mainland Australia. We've never heard anything about them. We've never seen pictures of them. You know, there's really been no big fuss made about those pre-existing or, you know, previous transfers. Mm.
In a sense, the fact that Christmas Island can be used answers one of the government's own complaints here about the bill, and that is that there is the scenario where somebody who has a serious crime alleged against them but hasn't served a prison term of 1 year or more might technically be allowed to get approval for a transfer to Australia for an assessment. Now, as Jackie just pointed out, a lot of people are currently in community detention when they come to Australia, and that is at the discretion of the minister. So the very fact that Christmas Island is available means that if there is such a criminal who gets through the safeguards in the bill, well, that's the kind of person who might be sent to Christmas Island.
So I'd like to get from you now an explanation or an understanding of how this bill came about. It was very unusual. It was unusual for a government to actually lose a vote of this significance in the House of Representatives. This bill came from the independents, didn't it, Jackie?
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, it really has its roots in the Wentworth by-election, where we saw Karen Phelps really riding the crest of a wave of discontent and anxiety, particularly within certain electorates. Obviously, Wentworth is one of them, about the treatment of detainees in our offshore detention centres, and about, you know, various reports that have been dripping out really for a year or two now about the dire mental health and the dire physical health, and in some cases the deaths of people in those offshore detention facilities. The main sort of, I think the peak of public dismay and anxiety came around the children in those detention centres, who I think most Australians started to feel really, really icky, for want of a better word, about the way that children were being locked up and the alleged or the reported mental health effects on those kids of being locked up. So Karen Phelps, you know, that was one of her platforms when she rode to her historic victory in the Wentworth by-election. That, you know, and she went to Canberra with a pretty strong mandate, and you've got to say that she has fulfilled it.
David, there was a lot of frenzied talk and speculation on Tuesday afternoon about a constitutional crisis. And, for a very short period of time there, some overexcited people were talking about the possibility of the government having to go to an early election or being unable to govern. How did that come about?
It was one of those days which we see in a hung parliament like this, where stories come up and they only last maybe a couple of hours before the whole issue is settled. But there'd been legal advice saying that because this medical transfer bill appointed this medical panel, and because the assumption was that the medical panel would be paid, it was therefore a money bill. And so that meant the government was at grave risk of losing a vote on the floor of the lower house on a money bill. Now, in the past, that's been a reason for a transfer of government or for an election. And that scenario lasted for a couple of hours before Labor and the crossbenchers decided to take that element out of the bill so that there was no appropriation. And it's interesting in terms of what was happening behind the scenes, because Tony Burke, the leader of the opposition, manager of opposition business in the lower house, was dealing with the crossbenchers and was making the point to the crossbenchers, look, you've said to me that you don't want this to be an issue of confidence in the government that would bring down the government, and therefore, you know, that's the explanation for taking that appropriation out of the bill and making sure that it wasn't the trigger for the loss of government. It was an interesting decision by Labor, because they could have gone harder and chose not to. And I find it interesting on the government side, they're still talking about this bill as if it is a huge matter of national security, and yet they don't use it as a trigger for an election either. Mm.
Mm. Well, what it certainly has done is put border security and boat arrivals squarely into the rhetoric for the approaching election campaign. We will come back and chat further about this after we take a trip to El Paso. Hello, we made it. So, Matt, where are you?
I'm at LaGuardia Airport in New York.
On your way back from?
From El Paso, Texas.
Matt Knott is the US correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age.
I was down there for a trip to the border. El Paso is on the US-Mexico border, and Donald Trump was there, the president, for his first rally of the year, and a very important one, because he went there to speak about his plans to build a wall with the clock ticking before the government is due to shut down again.
And he had talked about this town and this area in his State of the Union, hadn't he?
Yeah. Now, the State of the Union is a big nationally televised address, and he used it to mention El Paso as a justification for why a wall needs to be built. Now, a version of a wall, more a fence, people there call it, went up in 2009 on the border, and Donald Trump made quite a big claim that it had before been one of the most dangerous cities in America, and then the fence went up and it suddenly became one of the safest cities in America, and that produced an instant reaction from people from El Paso who said that is wrong, that is not the truth, we were never a dangerous city. And the statistics showed that they were right.
So what's it like, the city itself?
It's a really interesting place because just across the border is Mexico, and a city called Ciudad Juarez, which was until recently an incredibly violent and dangerous city. But it's essentially two cities two cities that are two halves of the one whole on either sides of the border. So there's an incredibly fluid movement back and forth. Some people live on one side of the border and walk over to the other. People have family members on both sides. There are various cultural events like art festivals that are held on both sides of the border. And I went up over to the bridge, one of the bridges where you cross, and it's a really placid, orderly place, kind of like if you went to one side of the Sydney Harbour Bridge or the Brooklyn Bridge, people just walking across, you pay a 50-cent fee to walk across. It's easy to walk across the side to Mexico, and all you need is your U.S. passport to come back. So it's certainly not now a lawless, violent frontier, and you can see stretching across a steel fence with see-through slats in it. It wouldn't necessarily draw the attention of the eye. It's not a big concrete wall. But yeah, it's a very interesting place and very much heavily Hispanic. You hear a lot more Spanish than you do English. So yeah, and it was a surprising place for Trump to visit because he only received about 25% of the vote there in the past election, very different to his usual strategy, which is to go to places where he's very popular.
And what sort of reception did he get?
Well, he did receive a massive crowd. I was out there waiting in the line with everyone else, and it was huge, no doubt about it. And many people had traveled from a long way. I spoke to one man who had driven 8 hours from Central Texas to come and hear him speak. People, you know, see it as a once in a lifetime opportunity to go and see Donald Trump. And there were many locals there as well. And I must say I was surprised by the crowd at the rally, how many were Hispanic American, you know, Spanish speaking people who were there supporting the president and supporting the idea of the wall. I think some people were just curious and wanted to see what the whole thing was about. It's very rare to get a president in El Paso. But yeah, that if you look at the polls, it would show you only about 30% of Hispanics would support Trump, but many of those at the rally were of Mexican heritage.
So what were they telling you about why they were there and why they support Trump?
Yeah, I mean, there's many different reasons. A taxi driver I was speaking to today was particularly pro-life is a big thing for some people in the Catholic Church, and that's the absolute issue for them. So they will support a president who is anti-abortion, and they will never vote for a president who supports abortion rights. So that's been a reason for a long time why our Republicans thought that they could make big inroads in the Hispanic community, because you know, there's a strong Catholic influence there. And people did say, well, while Trump did overreach in his comments about the wall, El Paso was never one of the most dangerous cities. They do say that border security has made a big impact there. It's not the ideal place for people who are opposed to any idea of a wall at all. In the 90s, they had this very interesting and very innovative operation at the time there, where a border patrol put basically a car every few hundred meters along the border to stop people from crossing over. They do say that in the 90s, you would walk across the bridge and you would see underneath people wading through the river. It was a very free and easy movement for people to cross illegally, and that stopped with the human, essentially a human wall, and then they built a physical barrier there. So it does make a difference. People argue over whether it's the most cost-effective thing to put it across the whole border, but people who've lived in El Paso for a long time, many of them do say that human wall and then a physical wall made a difference in their community.
Can you explain to me, like, you wrote in your story that 20,000 people walk across the bridge every day between Mexico and the United States here, and that 30,000 vehicles cross. What is it about having a wall that changes things when that many people are crossing the border? Is it because that the only freedom of movement really is for people with US passports?
Yes, exactly. So you're in trouble if you don't have a valid US passport or US visa. It's stopping that totally unregulated immigration of people coming across without any permission to be there.
And so Trump's visit, how did it go? Do you think it, what was the atmosphere like there for him? I know, obviously he got a big crowd.
Well, it turned aggressive for one BBC reporter who got attacked. It just showed, it was the epitome of what it's like in the Trump era, in that you had his rally there, a huge amount of support for him, people coming from all over the state, and then just a few blocks down the road, you had a counter-protest where Beto O'Rourke, who went, many people would have seen him competing last year for the Senate against Ted Cruz, and he narrowly lost, and he's considering running for president. He held a counter-rally, and I spoke to people who had driven the same. They'd driven from Dallas for about 10 hours to protest against Trump on the wall. And while the crowd estimates are a little bit fuzzy, you know, the two rallies were in the same ballpark of people attending. So it just shows how Trump has this amazing effect, both pro and negative, just exciting people around this issue.
He certainly knows how to get the eyeballs. So where is he now? He could be headed for another shutdown over this very issue, couldn't he?
Yeah, but the thing is, nobody wants another shutdown. I mean, no one wanted one in the first place. But it was seen as a disaster for Trump, and Republicans were getting very angry about it. So there is no appetite for another shutdown, and I don't think Trump even wants that to happen. The Democrats and the Republicans have been negotiating, and they have come up with a deal amongst themselves that involves some funding for the wall, about $1.3 billion for border security. Now, that is much less than the $5.7 billion that Trump was asking for. So the question is he going to take this bit of money and then try and build on it? There's talk of appropriating some money from the Defense Department and the Army engineers without even having to do an emergency declaration and just bank that and move on, or whether he's going to play much more hardball. Already some of the conservative supporters in the media are saying that this is a garbage deal and he needs to hold out for much more. But really, I think when you speak to these the people at the rally who support him, they are such true believers. If he takes credit for a few billion dollars for fencing and says it's all happening and we'll keep getting more, they will go along with him on that, because they believe in him implicitly and what he says. So I think it would be smart politically for him to take as much as he can and then move on.
Matt, anything else to update us on in Trump land before we go?
On the Democratic side, very interesting movements around this thing called the Green Deal and trying to make big movements on environmental policy, which is really interesting because the amount of prime ministers we have changing over climate change, it hasn't been such a big issue here. And there's now becoming quite a radical in America proposal being put forward about completely moving away within 10 years from fossil fuels. And Trump and the Republicans are really excited about that. They see that as a chance to rally their supporters and paint the Democrats as a very extreme and against fossil fuels. So climate change is going to be a big part of American politics, as it has been for Australian politics now.
Matt, thanks so much for your time, and we'll catch up with you soon.
Thank you.
Peter Harcher here, political and international editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. In an era of fake news and shifting global power, it's critical that your news is genuine and independent. Our reporters in Asia, Europe and the US work hard to report global stories and how they affect our region. Independent reporting on the ground is crucial to the integrity of our coverage, which we could not do without our subscribers. Support news you can trust and subscribe today.
Okay, welcome back, Jackie and David. I want to go straight to the issue of how Australian voters feel about people in offshore detention, because the independents have made a very strong case that they are hearing from electorates that people want asylum seekers in offshore detention to be treated more humanely, and that it's a big issue for them. I would like to know how we ended up in that situation. I'm going to give you a number first. From the years 2007 to 2013, 853 boats arrived, carrying 51,944 asylum seekers. And it was during that absolute flood of people coming on boats that these policies were put in place and had a lot of support. Mm. Is it just the case that because the boats have stopped and because we're no longer facing that flood of people and the horrendous, you know, deaths at sea, that the electorate's mood has changed?
I think that's definitely hugely part of it, because the horrible deaths at sea that we saw and the parliamentary response to them was really, it was tragic and it was heartfelt. However, I do think that perhaps the government is slightly out of step with public sentiment on this one, because in a sense we've seen one humanitarian crisis replaced with another, and it took a few years for that humanitarian crisis to really mature. And I just don't see that you can really express or describe the situation in those detention centres as anything other than that. And the fact is that people, you know, these people are under the care of the Australian government, and you've got to say that that duty of care has not been particularly well discharged, particularly in a few really high profile cases. I think that the fact that the independents have sort of found a way through the system to bring this issue to national prominence, and also to, you know, to make these extraordinary amendments, historic amendments, shows you that the government is a little bit out of step with public sentiment on this. And for me, you know, I thought that for me the tipping point was seeing particularly the issue of children in detention was on the front cover of the Sunday Telegraph like a few months ago. And also you had people like Carl Stefanovic on Channel 9 on the Today Show, which is very much a middle Australia kind of show, talking about this issue in really emotive terms. And for me, I was like, okay, they're good bellwethers of middle Australia, so-called middle Australia, and middle Australia has turned on this issue.
David, do you think that Scott Morrison would be looking at this as a political opportunity to sort of fight a Tampa-style election, or is he driven more genuinely by a fear of boats starting again?
Well, I think he's driven by his own experience as minister when the coalition government did stop the boats after 2013. So that is definitely a driver. But let's be honest, the government's in a very dire state. They've had a lot of internal turmoil. They've removed two prime ministers during their time in power. So they're looking for everything that they can use to win the next election. And this is a very powerful issue for them to campaign on, and they are going to campaign hard, and that does mean that there will be a vigorous scare campaign. However, there's one thing to add there. Getting back to Jackie's point, I think that on parts of this issue they actually are in touch with community sentiment. Bill Shorten talks about this amendment as being about humanitarian need and looking after the welfare of people, and that is a fair justification for his position. However, it's also true that when the government talks about protecting the borders, that experience after the 2007 election is still a recent memory. And so I think that they are in touch with the electorate in terms of the general belief among, I think, a majority of Australians that they want strong border security. And that's been shown in research by the Monash University Scanlon Foundation, which finds that there is that majority support for turning away boats, for instance. It is very hard-hearted, but it does have that support in the community. Whenever the government talks about this issue, they're going to be talking about those turnbacks and the boat arrivals. You can see from Bill Shorten's side, whenever he talks about this, he talks about the humanitarian aspect.
I do think that there is obviously still strong support for boat turnbacks and for having quite a restrictive or a punitive, however you want to call it, like a hard border protection regime. I think there's mass public support for that. However, I think where public sentiment is starting to turn is whether or not it is the black and white issue that the government portrays it as. Do we need to take these harsh measures at the expense of human life? And is cruelty, the cruelty that we've seen in those detention centres, does that need to be baked into the system for the system to be effective? That's where I think public sentiment is turning a little bit.
This is the fundamental thing, and this is why it's an interesting disagreement to have now, because the question is, Well, how powerful is that going to be when the government makes that case about the recent history? That's the most powerful argument the government's got. Set aside all the scare campaigns about criminals coming to Australia. The most powerful argument the government's got is Labor's own record when it was last in government. And that's the thing that taps into recent memory. And I think that's the thing that makes this issue one that is so dangerous for Labor, because in recent years, the polls have shown that Bill Shorten's ahead. He never seems to lose that lead. The big question now is this issue so powerful he could actually lose his lead? It's a fascinating moment.
Yeah. Do you think it is a case that literally the first boat over the horizon that washes up on the shore at Christmas Island could change the whole trajectory of the election campaign, David?
I think it could, yes. I think that scenario is quite foreseeable. Now, the government says that turnbacks work. So on the government's own rhetoric, we should not see that boat. But there is that sense you get from all the government's rhetoric. They're almost wishing for that boat to appear.
That's a big call. There was a fascinating exchange in Scott Morrison's press conference on Wednesday about nuance, because this bill does ring fence this right to medevac to existing detainees and existing asylum seekers. And in theory, that should prevent people smugglers being able to make the case to a new cohort of desperate potential customers that they should start coming to Australia. But Scott Morrison said very clearly that people smugglers don't work on nuance. All they need is one hook for them to sell their message to desperate people.
That makes sense to me. I mean, that makes obvious sense that as a marketing tool, you would use this if you're a people smuggler. However, we have also heard contrary rhetoric from the government for the last, I don't know, the better part of the last 5 or 6 years, that the people smugglers watch Australian politics very, very closely, and every single transgression, every single loophole, every single tiny policy difference is then sort of translated back to, I don't know, apparently the hordes of people who are waiting on Indonesian shores to come over to Australia. Those two things don't marry up for me. And we live in a very globalised world. I mean, and people, potential asylum seekers or would-be asylum seekers are presumably able to read the Australian news and the Indonesian news, or I don't know, the news in Arabic, just as easily as we can read it here. I mean, everybody's got a smartphone. I'd be interested to see how that translates. We will see. I mean, we will actually see whether or not we get new arrivals.
Yeah. So finally, we all thought this election was going to be fought on the economy and the response to the Royal Commission. How big do you think this debate will loom during the election campaign?
Events will decide that, in a sense, because the government's own plan is to actually change the subject before the election campaign begins. And I find that very interesting. They want to have their April 2 budget before they go into the full campaign mode. So that means that they will run a scare campaign on boat arrivals, but they'll also be talking about the economy because they regard it as one of their strong suits. Now, Labor will have a lot of things to talk about on health, education. They have what is still, I think, the fairness campaign that Bill Shorten began in 2014, that they are still going on in terms of increasing taxes on some people in order to make the system, in their words, fairer. So both sides actually will change the subject, but this will be a constant issue all the way to polling day. And I think it's interesting in terms of Labor's calculations here, because I heard during this week a fair bit of analysis about how Bill Shorten has been a small target for so many years. He's actually never been a small target. He opposed the May 2014 budget. He came out with the negative gearing changes. He did the dividend imputation changes, all very contentious. And now he's made this call on border protection. They're all very big calls. And what we've seen in recent years is every time he makes a big call, he doesn't lose his lead. The question is whether making a big call like this on border security actually changes that dynamic.
Well, we've got one more sitting week left before an April budget and then a likely election campaign. David, what do you think the big theme will be next week?
Next week, It's so far ahead, I can't imagine it, Tori.
You can't tell me what will happen this afternoon.
Well, we've just seen that the government stepped back on arguing over its energy bill, and so it's become much more cautious about what it takes to Parliament after that defeat this week. So we'll see. Senate estimates, I think, will be some of the big news next week, because in the Estimates Committee hearing, we're going to see some probing by Labor of border security officials, of defence officials, about some of these claims being made about new boat arrivals.
Jackie, David, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Tori.
Thanks, Tori.
Thanks to our guests this week, David Crow, Jack Malley and Matthew Knott. If you know someone who would enjoy this week's episode, make sure you share it with them. Or better yet, grab their phones and get them subscribed to get new episodes every week. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Support the work we do. You can find the link to sign up in our show notes, or just pop subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age into your search engine. This episode was produced and edited by David Escort and Rachel Dexter. Technical assistance from David McMillan, and Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori. Thanks for listening.